Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, a mystery illness in Vanessa Potter's Patient H69, and then the long relationship between humans and pigs in Pierre Spry Marquez's Pig Pork. Vanessa Potter is a former television producer turned science communicator. Since her mystery illness, which will become apparent as we talk in this interview, Vanessa has worked on science art projects with neuroscientists at the University of Cambridge, given a TEDx talk in Ghent, Belgium, and written several articles for The Telegraph and Marie Claire. She's currently working on a collaborative EEG project with her science friends in Cambridge, and just hot off the press, been nominated as an inspiring woman in the Inspiration Awards, which you can vote for online. Vanessa is the author of Patient H69, the story of my second sight. Vanessa, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you very much. What a wonderful introduction.
Let's talk about something about your life before the episode that this book is about.
Okay, so like you say, I was a TV producer. I worked in the London advertising industry for 16 years, mainly working for ad agencies. So I'd spent my career making TV ads, ads for toilet roll, radio ads for the army, a whole selection of different things. And I'd actually taken a little break because I had two very small children. They were only 2 and 4 at the time. So I took the summer holidays off. And I was in just at the other end of that and getting my daughter ready to go to her brand new school. It was reception, so she was starting. So I was putting time aside for the kids. And then bang, yes, everything changed.
So where were you when you first noticed that something was up?
Well, actually, it's really difficult to know when it all started because I had this really awful bug, like a knock you out, worse than flu, kind of emergency doctor, kind of 2 week bug. I got to the other side of that. And on that weekend that I started to feel better, we went off to the Malvern show and I coped. I did the show, came home, then just felt rotten on the Sunday night. That was the first time I didn't feel right again. And then on the Monday morning when I woke up, that's when the very first kind of obvious symptom kicked in. And that was a sense of feeling very dizzy, just weird. I was unstable, I was unbalanced. I felt like there was a fuzzing in front of my eyes. Very difficult symptoms to describe because actually you could easily confuse them with being exceedingly stressed or something. It was that kind of static that you get when you're in shock, maybe. So very strange symptoms. And that was that Monday morning.
And so you go to the doctors, and of course, what can you say? I feel a bit weird, there's something not quite right. So what's your first contact with medical professionals like at that point?
Actually, it was very good. I saw a locum doctor, and she could easily have just sent me away. Stressed mother. Very easy to label me as that. But actually, she was extremely thorough, and she did a lot of tests, which I now understand were testing my vestibular system. And of course, that was all over the place. So I felt very nauseous and very dizzy when I moved my head. So that she was alerted. So she got me sent off to A&E pretty sharpish.
And so things rapidly progress. What happened?
Yeah, rapid is the word. I spent a very frustrating first day in hospital, got sent home, couldn't find anything wrong. But the next morning when I woke up, which was actually my daughter's 5th birthday, and as the second I opened my eyes, my heart sank because I just knew something was really wrong. The world was muddy. It was like covered in a brown, murky haze. And even though I was blinking my eyes, it wasn't clearing. And as I looked around my room, I think I described it at the time as, it's like I've got sunglasses on and I'm inside. But of course I didn't. So it was very frightening. And I went straight downstairs. I don't even think I spoke to my husband. I just looked at him and said, we're back to A&E. And we did. We just went straight off. And then things went very fast from there. I never left hospital again. And within 72 hours, that murky brown haze had basically gone into like a halo. And my sight diminished literally hour by hour. I described it as kind of every time I blinked my eyes, I washed away a bit more of sight because that's what it was like. I stared at a notice board and I could see the letters fading, which is just horrifying. So within 72 hours, all my sight had gone. I was completely blind. But also what had happened is I started with this strange numbness in the just in my fingertips, like on a very cold day where your fingers are frozen. It was like that. But then it crept. And in fact, it crept so quickly, I didn't even know. And so I remember trying to stand up at one time and my legs were numb. I didn't even know. I mean, that's when the shock was starting to hit me because it was like, what is happening? And of course, the people around me, the neurologists that I ended up with, were like, we don't know.
So within 72 hours, you're basically completely blind.
Yes, and actually completely blind. So no light whatsoever. The world was completely black.
So literally, this is what I was going to say, because I, having never been blind, just blithely imagine that it's just like when someone switches off the lights and you're in a really dark room. So was that what it was like?
No, it's much more enveloping. It's like it goes inside your head. And also, we rely upon our vision so much to orientate ourselves. So I was very, and because I had sensory loss in my arms and legs, I was disoriented. I didn't know if I was up, down. I didn't know where I was. I was very, very unsteady and unbalanced and frightened.
So obviously you can't see, which is terrifying enough, but also you're losing the ability to walk. And these are both incredibly scary things in themselves, but also you're left really feeling vulnerable. There's a scene in the book where you actually, when you're going home, your husband goes to move the car and you're left on a bench. Mm. And you describe what it feels like to be ostensibly abandoned there, incredibly vulnerable. Tell us about what that felt like.
Yeah, it's strange when you have no sight and those around you do. And as a sighted person, you are very acutely aware of that. And so all my other senses were on high alert. And what happens when your major senses are knocked out is all the more subtle senses start to creep in. So I had heightened awareness. So I would have fear and I would be uneasy because I know there's people around me, but I can't see them. So I have all these signals and all these messages coming to me by other more subtle routes, which are very confusing. And it's very isolating, actually, because also if you look at me, whilst I didn't look well, you didn't know I was blind. And at that stage, I was still legally blind. So, yes, it's a very, I wouldn't want to revisit it. It's a very frightening time.
And of course, how is this affecting all the people around you?
Yeah, that was tough for them because I think my husband felt utterly helpless. You know, he was watching me deteriorate at such a rapid rate, and particularly when the doctors are going, scratching their heads going, we don't know. I mean, they called me this mystery patient, which doesn't help, actually. And my children, they didn't see me. I was in hospital for 16 days. So that was tough on them. Although I say tough, actually, because it wasn't really. They were little and they had friends and family taking them out for days. So I think they were very distracted. But then my daughter wanted to ring me and we had a conversation when I was still in hospital. So she was that bit older. So she still remembers it. My son was 2. He doesn't. But yes, it unsettled all of us. It unsettled our community. You know, people were shocked and trying to help as much as they could. They used to drop food off so my husband didn't starve, and people helped. People took the kids. The community really rallied round. Crystal Palace is an amazing place for that. There's a very strong bond between people there and people help each other, which I'm very grateful for.
Still at this point, we don't know what it is. So what's going on around you in terms of diagnosis? What are the doctors doing?
Well, they did give me the best guess diagnosis, which is NMOSD, which is basically a neurological autoimmune condition. It's extremely rare. And they couldn't really say much more than that because I'm not actually a classic case. I don't really tick all the boxes. But that was the closest they could get.
But that comes quite later on. There's a period of time when they're saying, rather than saying we know what it is, there's a period of, well, it's not this, it's not this, it's not that.
yeah, they ticked off the nasty list, as I used to call it. They'd come in and they'd be a bit disappointed.
Oh, it's not a brain tumour.
It's not a brain tumour. It's not cat scratch syndrome. It's not multiple sclerosis. Oh, and I'm like, isn't that good? Yeah, I mean, for doctors, of course, they want to get to the bottom of it. Mm. But I was very glad they were ticking those horrible things off the list.
Now, at the 72 hours, you're at this point where you're completely blind. That's terrifying. Things gradually start to improve. And in some ways, obviously, it's great that you start to get better, if that's the right word. But things get even weirder at that point because interesting things start happening as your vision starts to come back, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, you don't flip a switch and your vision comes back on. And in fact, I banned the word seeing for an awfully long time because it wasn't anything like seeing had been to me before. So on the very first morning that I had some light sensitivity, which is all it was a shift. So instead of opening my eyes to this kind of black hole, this suffocating blackness, it was dark grey. And there were some kind of vague light forms to one side. But I would have to spend long minutes sort of staring to work out if it was paler grey at one side. I mean, that's what kind of vision we're talking. So there was no faces, no lines, no shapes, no nothing. And it took several days even before some lines would start to appear. But everything was flat. I described it as living inside an X-ray. And I think that's, to sighted people, that's probably the best way to describe it. It has a transparency, a sort of wateriness to it. There was nothing substantial.
You said after 16 days, you get out of the hospital, you go home. Before they let you home, there's this, which I'd never come across before, this amazing and rather British test to see whether or not you're allowed out of hospital. What did you have to do?
Yeah. I used humour a lot in the hospital. It's a coping mechanism. It's very successful. If the poor woman who's blind in the bed is making jokes, everyone relaxes. And they took me off to do this. It's a test, basically, to pass, to get out of hospital. And you have to make a cup of tea in this makeshift kitchen. And so I was cracking jokes, but I very quickly stopped cracking those jokes because it was the most difficult thing I've ever done. So yeah, I had to stand first of all, take my own weight on my legs and stand at a countertop and turn a kettle on. In fact, I had to fill it with water first, turn a kettle on, find a mug, put a tea bag in and pour the water. It took me half an hour and I was shaking and sweating by the end of it, but I did it. And it really made me realise how far I had to go. Yeah, I joked when I came in, but I didn't when I left that kitchen, no.
We keep talking about the blindness as if that's almost the sexier aspect of this thing. But of course, it's easy to forget that you lost the ability to walk properly as well. So how did that come back?
I was not going to stay paralysed. I think that was a mental decision. It's like with my sight, I was so determined I was going to get it back. And so I started doing all sorts of sensory stimulus. And one of the occupational therapists says, look, you can stimulate. You can make your brain start talking to your feet again. So I was like, right. So I sent my husband and my sister-in-law off home, and they came in with all of these objects. So we had cotton wool, we had scratchy scourers, I had a potato peeler. And then we rubbed these things up and down my feet to try and make me reconnect to what were basically numb lumps of flesh. They weren't connected to me. But over time, by doing that, it made those connections start up again, and I started to be able to wiggle my toes and get some sensory responses, which everybody was ecstatic about, because if you start with that, you've got something to work with. And yeah, so I worked really, really hard on my mobility and with my fingers and my hands to try and stimulate some kind of response.
And in terms of the vision, you've mentioned that your sight was basically like living in an X-ray, so I was going to say black and white, but grey, basically. Mm. Lots and lots of shades of grey.
Yeah.
And it takes a long time for colour to start seeping back into your vision. And indeed, that happens in quite weird ways as well. You start to experience a bit of synesthesia. Tell us something about how you got colour back.
Yeah, colour was elusive. I desperately wanted colour. Colour doesn't, again, just ping back. It creeps. So I would be staring at our wooden floor. And of course, I know our wooden floor is like a pale pine colour. And I can almost be willing myself to see it. And that's kind of how it came. I would think, oh, does that feel a bit warmer? And I attached all the sensory responses before I had the visual cues. So reds and yellows would feel warmer. And I used to do lots of tests as well, get my husband and my family to hold coloured balls, and I'd stare at them endlessly, trying to fathom what colour this was. And so it was bit by bit by bit, and I had a very weird thing with red and green. When they started to reappear, they would flash intermittently between the two colours, which was very disorientating, because I'd be staring at, you know, the green grass, and it would be going red, green, red, green, red, green. Okay, no, you're green, red, green, red, green. So it was like my brain was misfiring. But over time, that stabilised. But then when blue started to reappear, blue went absolutely crazy. And I turned a corner walking one day, and I came across a blue recycling bin. Now, I knew it was a blue recycling bin. And this bin looked like it was lit up. It was sparkling and fizzing. And the blue was like an effervescence. It was actually moving. And I stood transfixed, going, what is going on in my brain? But what I found is that if I went up to the bin and touched it, that fizzing would stop and it'd become a flat blue. And that was the synesthesia. And actually, it was that that really prompted me to have to find out what was going on in my brain. That was really the critical moment. I was like, that is so weird. I have to know what it is.
There's a point in the book where when you're first in hospital and the doctors are, you know, have no idea what's going on, one doctor, who you call the bold doctor in the book, says, I think I know what this is. It's going to get worse before it gets better, but you will get better. Mm. Were you always confident that you would get better?
Yes, I believed him. And actually, this is something that happens with patients in very critical illnesses, I believe. You get mantras, you get statements, and you absolutely replay them over and over. And that's what we did. We had a few of those. But yeah, it was kind of helpful. And actually, also by saying it's going to get worse, I felt like I was prepared. So it's okay, we're going to go all the way, but we're going to come back. And yeah, whether it's craziness or not, it kind of keeps you sane, because you think there is literally light at the end of the tunnel. I'm an optimist. I've always been that way. And I think that very much came into this situation. And yeah, I was determined that I was going to see again.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Vanessa Potter. We're talking about her book, Patient H69, The Story of My Second Sight. Vanessa, tell us, who is Patient H69?
Patient H69 is a front. I hid behind this pseudonym because at the very beginning when I started writing, I wrote a blog, which was basically an extension of a diary that I had been recording on an MP3 player from day one, as crazy as it sounds. But it manifested into this blog. But I wasn't quite at a place where I wanted to put me out there. So I invented this pen name. And the H69 is basically the beginning of my NHS patient number. And it was great, actually, because it gave me a veneer and some protection until I kind of felt ready to stand up for myself. And by then, Patient H69 had become so well known that actually it became the title of the book, which it wasn't originally.
And at what point in this process did you actually start writing it down? When were you able to do the blog?
So the blog started at the beginning of 2014. So this is a year after I'd lost my sight. I had started trying to type before and I got very frustrated. The first part of my writing, I was typing at 36 point so I could see the letters. And actually that became a form of therapy in itself, because 2 weeks later I could reduce it to 28 and then 24. And basically, I remember the day it went down to 11 point courier. I was like, yes, you know, it was a measure. And without realizing it, I was kind of being scientific even about the writing. So the blog started being published in the beginning of 2014, but I'd been writing bits of it and putting it together before that.
And beyond that, the size of the font, very sort of reductive therapeutic method of doing it. Did writing about it help?
I get asked that question a lot. I suppose so. I just had such an overwhelming desire to communicate what had happened. So yes, it was a bit scary though, because you're writing about something incredibly personal. But I had such an overwhelming response to that blog, which I didn't promote. But people found it, and I didn't write it as perhaps as normal blogs are, which are independent posts. I wrote it as a narrative and linear. So it was the story starting on day one. And it's a gripping story and it's terrifying. And so people were following it. In fact, I was getting emails from people all around the world going, when are you posting next? I need to know what happened. I was like, okay. And that's when I realised I kind of had to keep going.
And also, I mean, why did you want to do it? Was it, in some ways, being able to write that is somehow a reaction to the, you know, to losing a sense, a reaction to being in a position where you might have lost your sight?
Yeah, for me, I suppose my motivation was to try and understand it myself. There's a bit of kind of processing that goes on when you write a journey like that. So there was a little bit of that, but there was also making it real. The more real it was and the more kind of big it was, and if people became interested, that kind of prompted me to go even further, because I hadn't started doing the scientific research then. So I think partly the response from other people, and people would say, what is it? And I go, well, I don't know. You know what? I'm going to find out. And so it was all part of that process of communicating, coming to terms with it a little bit, but then going, okay, I'm curious now. There's another adventure, another sort of simultaneous journey starting as well.
So let's talk about that, getting into the scientific research then. How did you go about that?
Well, I went straight away to the neurologist who treated me. I was under a very specialist team up at the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford, and they were great. I said, look, I need to learn about this. I need to understand it. And they were fab. They said, right, go away, read everything that Oliver Sacks has ever written. Let's start with Island of the Colourblind. So I did. I don't know if they thought I would, but I did. I pretty much read everything. And that really lit a fire in me. And that led to other books. He talked about Stereo Sue. And so I went and read Fixing My Gaze by Sue Barry. And that was incredible because so many things in her book I related to. I read John Hull's book, Touching the Rock. I related so much to that. And so all of these things were just part of the journey. And I was learning as I went along. And then, of course, things would come up that I would then research. So I was sort of knitting together this very basic knowledge of our visual system. But then I know I needed more help. So I started to try and network and find neuroscientists. Now, that's not easy. But in the meantime, I was writing a neuroscience exhibition. Because I basically thought that's what everybody would do. You have this experience, you go and write
art installation, of course.
It's just what you do. I mean, I know I sound so insane saying that, but it just felt the most natural thing in the world to do. Because, again, I wanted people to experience it. So I suppose I was in a different place from perhaps most people, most patients that contact neuroscientists, because a lot do. I went with a neuroscience exhibition and a way of communicating my experience and some questions about it. What I didn't go to them was Miracle Cure. So I suppose that opened doors for me.
So how do you, let's talk about that art installation, how do you go about communicating something that couldn't really be more interior? Like, how can you get across to me how this felt to you?
Absolutely. And that is why I wanted to use EEG, which is attaching electrodes to the scalp that record brain activity. Because I thought, you know, it's really hard to give such a subjective experience. And in fact, one of the things I wanted to tell people about was something I used during my recovery, which was meditation. And in fact, visualization and self-hypnosis, all these mental tools. And if you start talking about it and trying to put that as an exhibition, it just doesn't work. So I thought, you need to come inside my head. I thought, well, the only way to do that is through EEG. So one of the installations, I had about 25, used EEG. And that was kind of my route in to Cambridge University, because I contacted a neuroscientist there, Dr. Tristan Bekenstein, who studies consciousness. So, of course, his lab uses EEG all the time. And he was very interested. And that was kind of the door in, you know, and that gave me access to vision scientists and a whole host of other people.
I want to talk about a couple of other aspects of the science that you uncover in the book and some of the other neuroscientists. So there's Dr. Will Harrison. He's produced some images that are reproduced in the book of sort of visualizations of what you might have been seeing at that seeing X-ray point in your life. You talk about High and low spatial frequencies. What's that?
Oh, complicated, in a word. So our visual system, I described lines a lot to Will, and this is kind of how this all came about. And he said, you're talking about spatial frequencies, which is how we detect different lines and patterns within our visual landscape. And in fact, this brings in contrast sensitivity as well, which is, that's one of the first things I got back, which was, well, that was one of the part of my visual system that was deeply affected. So when I started to see light areas and dark areas, what I was actually seeing was the differences between those. And his visual algorithm was trying to depict the way that our brain likes to single out detail, which are the high spatial frequencies. He was basically taking my descriptions. We worked together and bounced backwards and forwards on these images and stripped out loads of visual information just down to the spatial frequencies, which is basically, they look like, I mean, they're very thin, watery images. And in fact, it was eerie looking at them because I was like, that's what it was like, which was great in some respects for him because he could go, right, cool, I can, you know, I can relate to this on a scientific level. So it was kind of educational for both of us in a weird way.
And you mentioned the bin, the blue bin, and the sort of fluctuation between the red and green, the ball on the lawn. You talked to Professor, is it Jamie Ward? He's a leading researcher into synesthesia. What's going on in your brain when this is happening?
Well, we'd love to know. I'd still love to know. We know a little bit about perhaps what might have been going on. Yes, I did talk to Jamie Ward initially just to find out if my descriptions matched what synesthesia might be, which is where our senses cross over. And yes, it's a weird form. It's not a classic form. Mine was colour touch. So in other words, when I saw a blue bin fizzing, my sense of touch affected my vision. So that makes it pretty much, you know, a cross-modal thing. It makes it synesthesia, but not a standard synesthesia. It's actually called acquired synesthesia because you acquire it probably, I mean, you can acquire it for different reasons, but brain injury is a classic one.
You mentioned in the book, at the point of your deepest blindness, you were still dreaming in colour. Mm. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, I think in some respects, this is like your brain practicing seeing. And in fact, one of the reasons I use visualization so much was so I could see. Because, of course, I didn't know it then, but our visual system is in our brain. It's not our eyes. So we see with our brain. So I could still, in my mind's eye, see. And in fact, I got quite accomplished using visualization. So I could actually, I pictured a beach and I could have the waves move and I could change the intensity of the blues. And I think that manifested and went into my dreams. So all of that visualization was basically my visual system keeping seeing alive.
And in terms of getting that colour vision back then, clearly there's a difference between, you know, having experienced colour before when you try to recover it compared to somebody who has been blind all of their life.
Yes. I mean, I had knowledge. I'd learnt the rules of seeing. So I'd learnt the rules of colour, which is why sometimes the experiences were so strange, because it didn't fit. And that was one of the things I recorded a lot, where it was things did not fit. But then over time, it's like I would relearn and make them fit. Yeah, so I had a relationship with colour. And I had quite a strong relationship with colour, I realise now, probably through my job and doing photography and being an artist. So I was quite sensitive to colour, which is why I think I had a more of the subtle sensory cues telling me that something I was looking at, whilst I couldn't see it as red, it felt red. So there's obviously visual information coming by non-visual routes. And I think having that prior relationship, of course, would be enormously helpful in reconnecting those dots and making my brain kind of identify and perceive that as red.
Just to finish off then, I want to talk about where you are now, I guess, because I asked at the end of the first part, that doctor said you will get better and whether or not you were confident that you were going to get better. But there has been permanent damage, hasn't there?
Yeah, I am now partially sighted. I have some visual disturbances. So I don't have full colour. So I have some colour loss and I have like a visual disturbance over my entire visual field and quite low contrast sensitivity. So it's difficult for me to differentiate like curbs or steps, things like that. Or in darkened areas, I struggle a little.
And is that that, or will that continue to improve?
Hey, never say never. I'm an eternal optimist, and whilst, yes, I live with it, and absolutely, I get on with it, I have lots of strategies, I will never say that's how it has to be forever because of the incredible plasticity of the brain. I know how much it's already got me to here. And so, I'm still curious on whether we can I can work on that and get any improvement.
And the final question, I guess, is NMO, could it recur?
NMO is a recurring illness normally. The doctors believe with me I had something called a monophasic episode, which is basically a very big one-off hit. You require particular antibodies to trigger NMO, and I don't have those antibodies. So fingers crossed they're right, and the one-off was the one-off.
I've been talking to Vanessa Potter. We've been talking about Patient H69, The Story of My Second Sight, which is out now from Bloomsbury Sigma Books. Vanessa, thank you so much for coming in and telling us your story.
Thank you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Helen Scales, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a podcast about ideas and culture.
P.S. Bri Marquez is a communications officer at the University of Cambridge. A zoo archaeologist, her research has taken her across Europe and across time, from the late Iron Age back to the Ice Ages, identifying, classifying, and decoding the meaning of animal remains in human-associated deposits. Originally from Spain, Pia is predisposed to a keen understanding, awareness, and love of the pig, and the many tasty pork products that are so much a part of Spanish cuisine. And so that's led to Pig Pork, Archaeology, Zoology, and Edibility, Pia's book. So Pia, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you.
So Pia, first of all, tell us what a zoo archaeologist is. What did you research?
Well, basically, a zoo archaeologist is an archaeologist of animal bones, but not in the sense that in the sense of a paleontologist, but animal bones that are related to human existence. So these are animals that would have had some kind of relationships with the human beings. And what I did was analyze the kinds of bones that were deposited in these archaeological sites, what kinds of animals there were coming from, how they were being butchered, how they were being skinned, and so forth, to sort of build a global picture of what humans were hunting, what species they preferred, or whether they were basing their choices on what was available locally and so forth. So sort of building a picture of, I guess, the original paleo diet in a way, the animal side of the paleo diet, because of course they were also eating other plant foods. It's not just all meat.
Tell us about some of the places that you dug then. So you mentioned in the book Croatia and Ukraine as places where you've been on sort of expeditions looking for these bones.
Yeah, my first archaeological excavation was in fact in Cambridge during the training dig that we did as undergrads. But I have spent most of my archaeological career working in Croatia firstly in the northern part of the country in Istria, which is a peninsula close to Slovenia and Italy, and then further south on one of the islands called Korčula, which is where Marco Polo was from, actually, during Venetian times. So I've sort of worked in different areas of the country and different periods, and my PhD was on a Croatian site. I've also worked in Ukraine, trying to find Neanderthal sites in Ukraine, and I've also excavated in Libya as part of a project that was being carried out in my department.
So why pigs then? How did you end up writing a book about pigs?
Well, I sort of tried to explain in the introduction that people were surprised to hear that I was writing a book about pigs, because no one in archaeology associates me with pigs. They associate me with red deer, because red deer was a very, very common species in the Paleolithic in Croatia and was consumed quite heavily. So it was a bit surprising for many people. But I wanted to learn about the pig, because obviously I knew a lot about red deer from my PhD, because it had featured so prominently in my diet as a child. But I had realized that I didn't know much about the animal behind it. And that just got me thinking about our relationship with food. How much do we know about where our food comes from? So I've been eating all sorts of pork products since a, you know, very young age, living in Spain, where, you know, people are pork obsessed. But I knew nothing about the pigs. I hadn't seen pigs. Pigs weren't in cartoons. I didn't get to see them in farms. And I just felt there was a bit of a disconnect. And then I also wanted to see why there was this obsession with pork. And I have a historical interest in the Spanish Inquisition. And I wanted to see if there was indeed a link that pork features so prominently in Spanish gastronomy, because it is one of the things that Judaism and Islam have in common, that they have a taboo. So it was a very not easy but practical way for the Inquisition to see who was abiding by these new Catholic rules, because it was something that was common to their two targets. And that just one thing led to the next. And before I knew it, I was writing a proposal to write a book all about pigs and pork.
So where does the pig that we would see in a field driving along today, the domesticated pig, where does that come from then?
That comes, so there's two centres of domestication for the pig, independent centres. And the first one was in Turkey, in certain areas of what is now Turkey around 9,000 years ago. And then also in China around also 8,000 years ago. But obviously it's a tricky subject, because domestication is not something that happens overnight. So it's a gradual process. It's a relationship between the animal and the human. So we don't really know when this first interaction started to happen, but we can see that there was a change in the bones of these animals from wild boar to domesticates in Turkey around that time, and slightly later in China. So those are the two centres of domestication that we know of so far.
And so obviously the wild boars that existed to begin with, they would have, first of all, how would human beings first have started interacting with the wild boars? Obviously they would have been hunting them, but in terms of the steps toward domestication, how would that relationship have developed?
Well, there's different pathways to domestication, and the one that they think happened with wild boar was the wild boar approached human settlements in order to feed on the waste, and gradually just got closer and closer. So they, in a way, people say that the pig domesticated itself. It wasn't the human specifically targeting the wild boar. And it was just a way of gradually getting closer, to the point that then a strong bond developed between us and them. And that gradually led to their more full-on domestication, and obviously changes in their physical appearance and their behaviour and so forth.
And then, why pigs? I mean, obviously they're tasty, but there's aspects of the pig that makes it difficult to... I guess we're obviously at the point now where, you know, agriculture has started, so people are starting to settle in villages. But obviously with, like, deer, you can follow a herd of reindeer and you can be migratory. Cows and sheep both can be moved around quite easily. You can walk them to market and things. But pigs are a lot less mobile, aren't they?
Yes, a lot less mobile. They do like to walk from time to time, but they're not very good to transport over long distances. And this is one of the ideas, actually, that has been put forward to explain the taboo, the prohibition to eat pork in Judaism, because it was an animal which was very difficult to move around. And obviously, if you have nomadic groups, this is quite the impediment. And also they require a lot of water to survive and to thrive. And obviously, if you're in an area where water is restricted, this is a species that is not going to be an ideal animal to be keeping. And it's believed that these factors, as well as others, coupled with the fact that the chicken was introduced into the area at some point following the domestication of the pig, led to some groups to favour the chicken over the pig. And this is where the taboo emerge from, because not only do chickens require less water, but they also produce eggs. And if we think about pigs, they're an animal that doesn't provide us with many byproducts in the sense, you know, that a cow provides us with milk or sheep provide us with wool. It's just the meat. So they are very, in a way, expensive domesticates to have. So it's interesting that they have become so prominent, given how difficult or challenging it must have been to have them in the first place.
You mentioned that the pig takes a lot of water, and one of the surprising things I learned from the book is, although despite we'll regularly say in the summer that we're sweating like a pig, pigs don't actually really sweat, do they?
No, they don't. They don't have the ability, which in a way also ties in with this idea that we think that pigs are dirty, because they like to roll in the mud, when in fact, actually, they're rolling in the mud because they want to keep themselves cool, because they don't have the ability to sweat. So if they're exposed to the sun or to very high temperatures, that is the only way that they can keep their body temperature to an acceptable level. So that's why they like to roll in the mud, not because they're dirty, but because they just want to keep cool. And they're also very prone to getting sunburnt, which is also a big problem, because it can lead to all sorts of medical issues in pigs. For example, it can lead to abortions in the females, or even reabsorption of the fetus as a result of the shock from the sunburn.
And you can literally buy a pig sunscreen.
You can indeed, yes. There's all sorts of brands out there.
Say something about how pigs are farmed now. So say, for instance, in the UK or the US, I guess. What's a typical pig farm like?
Pretty productive. It's a non-stop production chain where the females are impregnated on a very regular basis. The farmers obviously take advantage of the fact that the females can have several young in a year. They're not constrained like other animals that might only have one litter every year. So this is exploited to the max. Piglets are weaned at a young age that just aims to maximize the amount of pork that can be produced given the available number of pigs per farm. And we all tend to think that, you know, we're all eating locally reared pork and from very nice farms, but as a matter of fact, more than 90% of pork is mass produced both here in the UK and in the US. So at some point in our lives, whether we've had a ham sandwich or anything pork related, any pork dish, it's bound to at some point have been factory farm.
But it's not all like that. You talk in the book about, you've already mentioned Spain and its particular relationship with pork, but you talk in the book about the Iberian ham, the Iberico ham. Tell us how those pigs are reared and how that ham is made.
Well, Iberico ham, if you've ever had Iberico ham, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful ham. Very, very tasty and very expensive if you buy the good variety. They're like la creme de la creme of the pig world, and they are basically let loose in one of the regions in Spain, and they just feed on acorns. As much acorns as they want, they just chomp, chomp, eat them all. And then the oleic acid from the acorns then nicely feeds into their muscles, which then gives the ham a very nutty taste and the right amount of fat. So it's a truly delicious ham, but obviously one that requires a lot of land and a lot of trees and special care of the pigs. So you basically pay for letting those pigs run wild amongst the acorn trees.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Pia Spry Marquez, and we're talking about her book Pig Pork: Archaeology, Zoology and Edibility. Pia, people would be familiar with feeding scraps of food to pigs. I think people have done it in the past and in wartime and things. People would collect their food in the same way that they recycle food now, and this would be fed to pigs. And this seems like a really a green and a good thing to do, but it's actually frowned upon, isn't it? Why is this a problem?
Well, I think we're still recovering from the shock of foot and mouth, which there was that outbreak back in 2001 that was traced back to swill feeding. And obviously the National Pig Association of Britain is very concerned that this might happen again. And they're not happy with campaigns like the pig idea, which wants legislation to change so we are able to feed the ginormous amount of waste that we produce every year, a part of it, that we can feed it to these omnivorous pigs. But the National Pig Association is just not happy, and there doesn't seem to be any changes going on at the moment, and the European Union is also very reluctant to change its legislation. But cases like the Japanese, where it is done on a government-sponsored scale, have proved that this is a perfectly safe alternative and one that actually helps reduce waste and reduces the amount of soybean that we feed to the pigs, which also has very, very important repercussions on deforestation and so forth, because most of the soya meal and bean that are produced around the globe are to feed farming animals, not to produce, you know, soya yogurts. So it would sort of help to very important issues.
And you also mentioned, in terms of staying with just environmental issues at the moment, where there's intensive pig farming, there are also huge problems with disposing of that pig waste. Tell us about that.
Yes, so I talk especially about the case of North Carolina, where they have these gigantic pig excrement lagoons, where they just have built systems as part of the intensive factory farming, where they just pump out the pig excrement into these giant lakes and then just process it in a way and use the sort of filtered water to then water other things that they might be growing around the area. They have had many problems with hurricanes making these lagoons overflow, which is obviously very catastrophic from an environmental point of view, because if this water then drains to different rivers, obviously it kills fish and all the flora around it. And I also recently learned that this is also very much a social issue, because these lagoons are placed close to very low-income areas where African Americans live and Hispanics live. There's all sorts of implications, environmental, social, and also health-wise, because many of the populations that live around these excrement lagoons do suffer from many kinds of respiratory cancer and many other diseases. So it's a big problem arising from factory farming.
You talked earlier about the taboos in Judaism and Islam about eating pork, and another one of the theories as to why that might be is because of diseases that we can get ourselves from eating pork. You've obviously mentioned things like foot and mouth already, and the respiratory diseases that can be got from living around the lagoons. But what sort of things can we actually catch from eating pork?
All sorts. Hepatitis E, for example, is a common one. Everyone tends to talk about Trichinella, the tapeworm, but there's many, many other animals actually that you can get it from. So that's Trichinella has been used as an explanation for the pig taboo, but in fact you can get Trichinella from bears and all sorts of other animals. So it doesn't really hold true.
Well, it's true to say that in those regions of the world where pork isn't eaten, the incidences are much lower, aren't they?
Yes, definitely, that is true. And I do provide some data from Spain, where pork is very popular, and Croatia. They do have many, many more cases of trichinosis compared to, say, Israel or other nations where pork is not as widely consumed. So, yes, there is some correlation there, which might not equal causation, you never know. But, yeah, it is true. Other diseases. So I came across a very interesting one where you get worms in your brain. Neurocysticercosis, which results from the ingestion of eggs of the pork tapeworm. And one of the effects of this is that it can sometimes lead to you growing these worms in your brain. And this is quite prevalent in countries where there might be infection through water because there's poor sanitary conditions and so forth. And it's a very prevalent disease in South America and parts of Asia. And it can lead to chronic headaches. And there's even been a link between the presence of these worms in people's brains and reversible Alzheimer's disease. There's a type of Alzheimer's that is caused through the presence of this worm, and by treating it through a normal course of antibiotic, and you can reverse the symptoms of this type of Alzheimer's. I'm not saying it's for all types of Alzheimer's, and it's something that you might not realize you have it. You just might have a few headaches from time to time, or in the case that I talk about in the book, you know, she ended up having hallucinations, but it's as simple as taking a course of antibiotics. But it's a very horrible disease to have.
Just a couple more things. You mentioned the Bay of Pigs and the invasion of the Bay of Pigs in the book, although it turns out that that's actually got nothing whatsoever to do with pigs. It's been misnamed. But there was a war, or almost a war, fought over the killing of a pig. I'd never come across this before. Tell us this story.
Yes, so this was a war between British Canada and the US, and they were deciding where to draw the line on the map and who got hold of an island. And so they all decided to settle the island until they reached an agreement. And there were American settlers and there were Canadian settlers. And then one of the American settlers had a vegetable patch, and one of the Canadian settlers had a bunch of animals, including pigs. And apparently there used to be this pig that used to like to go to the American's vegetable patch and eat his potatoes. And one day he said, "I've had enough of this pig," and killed it. And obviously the Canadian wasn't impressed, and it led to very much an international conflict of where to draw the line on the map and who did that island really belong to. And then it wasn't a violent war. It was finally resolved through international arbitration, but it was caused by the killing of a pig.
Just one more thing then. So as well as being a story of, you know, the history of our relationship with the pig, this book contains some amazing looking recipes, a couple with each chapter. But then recently you've decided not to eat pigs anymore. Why not?
I've just learned so much by researching this book and writing it. And I've learned so much about pigs, their intelligence, how much they've provided to us, but how little we've given back. You know, something that started as a sort of mutualistic relationship. They would come to our settlements to feed off our garbage, and we would get rid of that garbage through them, has then developed into a relationship in which we're just using and abusing them, and they're not getting much in return. And knowing what I know now, and knowing that I don't need pork, that I don't need meat, I don't need dairy or eggs to survive, it sort of made sense to honour the pig and everything I had learnt about it by not consuming it anymore. Pigs for me are now the animals their behaviour, their intelligence, their history, but they're not food.
I've been talking to Pia Spry Marquez. We've been talking about her book Pig Pork, Archaeology, Zoology and Edibility, which is out now from Bloomsbury. So Pia, thank you so much for coming in and telling me about it.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.